Welcome to this forum. The title is Celebrating Lutheran Women's Ordination, Past, Present, and Future, I think is the title that was up under the bell. And we who are participating in this forum up front here, the four women who have served Holden as village pastors in the past 20 years, and we'll introduce ourselves as we speak. We'd want to say one thing now, and we'll probably say it further down the road. We have at the door some paper and pens. And for our Bible study tomorrow, we thought we'd do two things. We'd make some comments about ministry and the Bible, and we'd also answer questions that you might have about ministry, the Bible, women, topics in and around those topics. And if you would do that before you leave tonight, then we'd have them to sort of sleep on. We thought we would share some personal things tonight and then open it up for conversation, and then along the way also perhaps interject some stories and observations from the time Nancy and I spent at Anaheim, which she's done a little bit already.
And Mary was part of that.
Right. And if anyone else was there, there were two events going on simultaneously, the celebration of Lutheran Women's Ordination and the Triennial Convention of ELCA Women, at which Mary was a speaker. And we'll go in order of our arrival on the scene at Holden, pastorally speaking. It's Nancy starts.
I'm one of the women who was referred to as at Anaheim as first generation. They kept doing that. you heard already part of my story. And at Vespers tonight, but a couple of things I wanted to share. I began seminary in 1972 at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. And when I began, Luther at that point had a student body of about 500 students. And they were my first year, my junior year, they call it in a seminary. There were 15 women total on campus. No, 11 my first year, 11 my first year. I think there were only seven of us in the MDiv program. The others were doing other programs. My second year, my middle year, there were 15 women on campus. I went away on internship and came back, and there were 62 women on campus. And that was really exciting, and it was a big change. The only hard part was that they still didn't have enough women's bathrooms, and so you had to stand in line sometimes. And before that, if you met somebody in the bathroom, you were surprised. Scary almost, you know. And it was a very interesting time to be around. It was very difficult at that point. The other students were not particularly supportive. They would say things like, well, it's real nice to have you in our classes, but if when you go to be ordained, then that's the, no more support. Things like that. I personally found, also the women were very, very diverse. I was pleased at Anaheim that my one friend from seminary was there, and Anaheim was sort of astounding that way, the 20th anniversary celebration we just had, because the here were some of the, quote, younger women, that doesn't mean they're younger in age, but younger in terms of ordination years, were all rushing up and greeting their, you know, 50, 60, 70 seminary classmates, not quite that much, but, you know. And, well, Mary Rao and I had a nice time visiting by the pool. There were two women in my class. Mary was in the class ahead of me, actually. So there have been a lot of changes since. I started seminary in 1972, and I'm glad for them. The presence of lots of different women makes a huge difference, and also in some of the issues that were being raised about acceptance and just the sheer numbers, although the numbers are not great. There are 1,100 currently women pastors in the ELCA. The clergy roster of the ELCA is 17,000.
That includes retired people, though, too.
Well, the active roster is about 14.
Well, I'm the next in line, and as I'm glad we can go by age, because I am the oldest.
Yeah.
But I didn't start seminary until 76. And I just sort of fell into it, you know. It's kind of like I had been a teacher, and I went from that into working for the church, and I liked what I was doing, and then they voted on the ordination of women. And I started thinking about it. I always tell this little story about me because I think it's so embarrassing. But, and that is that when they took the vote in the LCA in Minneapolis, I was a visitor there. I lived there, and I applauded the decision, but my response was, I think women should be what they want to be, but I don't think I would want a woman as my pastor. And that comes out of a whole lot of other stuff that had nothing to do with the scriptures or anything like that for me. It was just sort of a place where I was in my life. But I did feel called to ministry in some way, and I decided finally that I would go to seminary, and after some encouragement from one of the congregations in which I was working. So I chose to go to school in Berkeley. And I started in 76, and there were 30, I think there were only 30 women on the campus in 76. We were about one-third, though, of the student body. And graduated in 80, was ordained in 80, and have served in the Iron Range was my first call. And that's where the total exceptions came for me. Followed another woman, so she sort of broke the ground. And I think we were the first to do that in Minnesota, where one woman followed the ministry of a second woman. Then I spent a year here, and then I spent 4.5 years in Seattle. And so a very varied and up and down kind of experience as an ordained woman. But that's kind of my story.
Okay, I guess I'm third in line here. I'm Barbara Rossing, and I was here at Holden from 86 to 88. My story is somewhat like Nancy's in that Holden was a really big part in my deciding to become a pastor. I started coming here as a waitress in 1973 and worked for several summers as a waitress, and I also worked in the laundry one summer. And I was a geology major in college, but was kind of shifting over to thinking of going to seminary and did that right out of college. And just loved it, loved studying the Bible and studying theology. I'll tell a couple funny stories. In my internship congregation in Hutchinson, Minnesota, I had felt really accepted by them. I was lucky enough to follow an associate pastor there. I was the first intern they had always had two pastors, and so I sort of was treated like an associate pastor, and it was great. At my goodbye party, after a full year of internship, they had a goodbye party, and the president of the congregation got up to make a speech and said, it was hilarious, he said, "Yeah, when they told us from Luther Seminary we were going to get a girl, oh, we didn't know what to think." And he talked about it in the council, and we said, "Well, all right, we'll try it." You know, and he sort of and he said, "But now," and we didn't know what we think. We knew we didn't want a lady pastor or a girl pastor, but now we've been talking over, and we decided that we'd rather have a lady pastor than a man with a beard. So that was the great drawing of pastor right here.
Yeah.
People
think me a lot, though.
Sounds like giving birth. Is it going to be a girl or a boy?
Oh, anyway, so you know there's a hierarchy. Okay, the first choice is a clean-shaven man, but now I've managed to move women above men with a beard in the second place. Oh, that's one story. Anyway, then after I finished seminary, because I had such a good experience on my internship, I guess I wasn't expecting to encounter problems, and so I was, I don't know, one of the most challenging years of my life was 1981, when I was looking for a call and being interviewed by congregations and got turned down by a number of places. In the American Lutheran Church, my district that I was assigned to had several women on staffs as associate pastors, but not at that point any women in solo parishes by themselves. And the bishop wanted me to try to be the first one, and it didn't work out. In one place, the call committee had voted unanimously to call me, and the congregation didn't. So there, I encountered resistance that I wasn't expecting, and finally took my name out of the call process because I was getting really bitter about that. But then I was really happy. I had a really good job working at the National Office of the American Lutheran Church on the global mission staff, and that was a really good situation. I also ended up then about a year later getting a part-time call to a congregation in Minneapolis, which was really exciting, and spent a wonderful 3 years there. After that, I came to Holden as pastor in 1986, and had a great time here also. Really felt privileged to be able to be pastor here. I was amazed by that point in 1986 that there were still so many people who came up to me after every Eucharist saying things like, "You're the first woman pastor I've ever seen in my life. I've never heard a woman sing the liturgy. I've never heard a woman preach. I've never taken communion from a woman pastor." That after 16 years already of women's ordination in the Lutheran Church at that point, still, and I'm sure you hear it even now, Carol, so many people find it's a really moving experience to take communion from a woman pastor. Well, I can tell some more funny stories, but anyway, I'm glad I shifted out of geology into being a pastor, and it's been a joy these years. Oh yeah, I should tell about that. Okay, we were one really neat thing. I have an older sister who's a pastor. She's a year and a half older than me. Her name is Karen Ross and Grandall, and she's served in two parishes in western North Dakota. And I was really happy that she was the person then who ordained me. That the bishop gave permission to be the ordaining pastor. So we, I guess, were the first sister team of pastors in the American Lutheran Church. And we also have a sister who is a missionary too for the ELCA, an agriculturalist in West Africa. So that was really fun to be able to be ordained by my sister in 1982 in December.
And as you speak, I think that your ordination, Barbara, was the first ordination I'd ever attended. I've not even been to that many yet to this date, but that was wonderful, and an introduction to the power of that celebration. I guess I would also, in my story, give credit to Holden in my journey. I came here for the first time on volunteer staff right after I graduated from college in 79. Worked in the laundry, and I often speak of my path to ordained ministry as being a path of discovering gifts within other kinds of ministry or other kinds of lay ministry. And the first of those opportunities came because of someone I met here. So that's one way in which that path started, because of Holden, a job teaching at Golden Valley Lutheran College in Minneapolis. But I think it was also after those then two summers in a row on staff here, while the Shrams were here, that then I started taking some classes at Luther Northwestern, just part-time, sort of a look-see thing back in 1980. And I think that really did grow out of those summers here, being exposed to the feast of things here. I was one of those who hadn't taken many religion classes in college or anything. But I sort of stumbled on this path, sort of in the sense of kind of on again, off and again. I took classes part-time at Luther Northwestern from 80 to 82 while I was teaching at Golden Valley, and wasn't sure that was what I wanted to do, and so quit doing that for a while and had that kind of year of credits just sitting there. So potentially, early on, I don't know what we call ourselves if we started seminary in 80, that'd be probably edging toward being the second generation of women. When I took those classes there were about 30% of the MDiv students who were women, whereas in the MA program, about 60 to 70% were women, or the MRS program, as they called it.
I resent that.
I know. I didn't call it that. They called it that. Deanne was in that degree program. I think that's probably an example, though, of some of what was going on there then, and the clericalism that got mixed up in all of that, and who women are there. I continued to teach. I worked at the ALC offices when Barbara was there. I then happened into so those were different kind of ministry experiences, and then had the opportunity to work in a parish for a year in East Lansing, Michigan. And that was kind of a pivotal year for me in not being one of those people at seminary who kind of wanted to study that stuff, but they weren't really interested in ministry. I seemed to meet a lot of those folks. And that year in the parish then was, I speak of it as a kind of a conversion to parish ministry. And then I decided that, yes, I did want to go back to seminary. But I'd had a suspicion for quite a while that everyone in the world wasn't Lutheran. But hanging out in Minneapolis and Holden Village and Luther College and Golden Valley Lutheran College, I could pretend that they were. And so I decided that I wanted to go to a place that wasn't all Lutheran, and chose Harvard Divinity School. And when I was there, from 85 to 87, over half of the students were women. As is still the case, I think. And did my internship last then, after taking some more courses at Lutheran Northwestern, as we're required to do in that adventure of going, come on, Lutheran seminaries, we come back and get sanitized from. And so both my experience in the parish in Michigan and an internship at St. Olaf College and a parish in Northfield were very positive experiences. And then came here. This was then my first ordained call. And I guess that would put me in history-wise, probably almost in the third generation, if we're calling there to be a third generation of ordained women in the Lutheran Church. Rather new to the scene, although not new to circles of women in ministry in the church professionally. And as I've already participated in some of the call process looking for a next call, it so far has not felt like there's a lot of obstacles. I'd say one of the facts of being third generation is that I've not encountered much overt discrimination. I've not encountered many times when people have said to me, I don't think women should be pastors. It's sort of, now's the time when it's clearly uncouth to say that in most places and circles. And I think now the issues for women in ministry are, in ordained ministry, much more subtle, that the discrimination has kind of gone underground, and the burden is more on women themselves to figure out what's going on. Is it me? Is it them? Is it the situation? What's going on here? And I think that's reflected in the stories that women in ministry are sharing. When we get together, it's a lot of reality checking. This painful thing happened, and I'm not sure what this is all about. And Anaheim, for me, was a wonderful gathering. It was the first worship service when it was a woman from India who started by saying, I've never been in a place with this many ordained women. And Carol Nolte next to me said, neither have we.
Yeah, right. And the Prasanna cried.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just really powerful to be together with all those, for me, just many people in that room who have been kind of foremothers on the path, you know, women that I've looked up to in different places and situations. And very powerful to see, as they said, all those ordained from 70 to 75 stand, and you know, it's just a sprinkling in the room. 76 to 80 and a few more, and 81 to 85, lots more. And then just the cops that stood up from 85 to 90.
86 to 89, and half, more than half of them.
Yeah. I jotted down a few other Anaheim things.
Can I throw in one thing here about Prasanna Samuel? There are currently 150 women in the Lutheran Church of India who are prepared for ordination. And this year, the Indian bishops are meeting to decide their fate. We sent a petition from Anaheim to them, and please keep them and the Lutheran Church in India in your prayers. If Prasanna is any indication, they're powerful and strong women and preachers and wonderful. And they've been prepared for many years. Prasanna has been prepared for ordination for almost 10 years. Mm-hmm.
It was also pretty powerful at that gathering to have the clear presence of our multicultural and global sisters in a way that I had not experienced among ordained women before, and how that changed the tone of things, that they're kind of amens and clapping and things that just clearly changed the spirit of the gathering. One other image that sticks with me that did not specifically grow out of celebrating women's ordination there, but was at the closing worship of the women of the ELCA assembly, which I stayed for a day of. And I think it says something about just the mutuality of all our ministries. For both the opening procession and closing recessional, all the people participating in the service came in, and all the ordained women who were still around processed in that. But ending the procession, ending the recessional, was Jan Brosen, who is a pastor in Southern California and who was the preacher for that service. And she has cerebral palsy and was in a wheelchair. And also at the end of the procession was Bishop Chilstrom, who was participating in the service. And the procession ended with him pushing her in her wheelchair, and he had his big green chasuble on. And that image is just really stuck in my head as an incredibly whole image of the procession of the people of God, just so powerful. We want to open it up to conversation. Perhaps questions, and we might add to this, but questions of what have you experienced and noticed as being different in the church because women are ordained? Any questions that you might have?
I have a question. I was very struck, Carol, by your saying that you're not encountering sexism or discrimination in your job search now, and I'm curious to know whether...
Well, overt.
Overt. I'm curious to know whether, in the experience of the other three of you, you think, is it a generational thing? Are you running into it? Do you have friends who are running it? Do you think it's okay for women pastors to get jobs now? Do you think there's any overt discrimination? What would the others of you say?
I haven't experienced it in terms of getting a call yet. But what I just, what was interesting, I don't know, you never know the answer to that question. That's the other part of it, because I think Carol's, it's sort of subtle. Mm-hmm. It's much more subtle now. And in this last call, there were two people who voted against me for original call. And that was because they didn't really believe that women should be pastors, and they were very upfront about that, scripturally. They stayed, though. They opted to stay in that congregation and have become the two people that I've worked and feel I trust the most. Mm-hmm. And the woman, the wife, is still not so sure that God calls women into ministry, but that the relationship in the church and my ministry with them has been significant enough for her to call. They always call me pastor. There's never been, and they've always, it's just like it's been so clear. It's the subtle, there's some other subtle stuff, though, that is so hard for me. I think it's easier for women to be called to associate positions. and that the longer we're in ministry, if we were to want to go to a larger congregation, that there are fewer of those who are willing to call women at this point for that role. I don't know. Is that a generalization, do you think?
I think there are fewer women who are crazy enough to take those jobs.
But I'd like to answer. Are you done?
Yeah, that's my experience.
I think it's still a struggle, and clearly, I talk to almost all our women pastors, and I can get the phone calls when they come right out of seminary for their first interviews. And one of the discrepancies we have now is that women are pretty comfortable in seminary. There are a lot of women there, and it feels good. It is still true, though, that for the vast majority of women, when they come out of seminary, their first call will be the first time that parish has had a woman pastor. And that's going to go on easily through my lifetime, I think. That's going to be the majority rule, is that that's true. And so getting through the interview process is the hard part. Being pastor in a parish is a snap. It usually takes folk one Sunday. That's Lutheran folk. I mean, all you Lutheran folk understand, those of you that are Lutheran folk, the office of the pastor. Nobody's ever bothered to teach you that. But the Lutheran office of the pastor is that it's not the person, it's the office. And the person exercises the office. And so Lutheran people say, well, you know, they go through one Sunday and they get used to the change in sight, color, shape, sound, all that kind of stuff. And then they say, well, the word got preached, sacrament got offered. Fine. But still, getting in the door then to those places that may not have been to Holden Village yet, may not have a lot of women pastors in their area, so they haven't experienced them at their synod assemblies yet, or that kind of thing, there are still difficulties, and they still ask dumb questions, you know? And they just come out, but what I'm concerned about is the women coming out now, many of them are not prepared for that. They think that it's going to be easier than it is. The other concern I have along those lines is, I want to put this easily, if there are any other male clergy in the room, you can respond to any other male clergy, any male clergy. Oh, I've been in this job too long, I've changed this anyway, but we're getting a lot of scared men. The office is different now. It doesn't have the same securities, the same safeguards it used to. It is no longer true that you will come out of seminary, you will go to a parish, you will get a call from that parish and go to another parish, and you will keep doing that until you retire. And that is very frightening for men who have expected that. And we talk about that among our women pastors now, and we say, how can we care for our brothers in some of their fear? And it's a real item. And that's where a lot more overt stuff is coming now, in my experience anyway, among the two women clergy. So my image about, I'll say one more thing, my image about that right now is what's happened in 20 years is that what happened was the door got opened, but the room didn't get rearranged. And after 20 years now, we have just gone in and we're sitting down, folks, you know, and we're not being too particular about who's already in the chairs, and we're even starting to move the furniture. And it's scary for some people. That's been my image over about the last year. Yeah. I mean, we're not being awful about it. It's just happening.
I've made a point while I've been in the Northwest of trying to go to several of these clergy women gatherings of women in the Northwest, and you know, found them to be a wonderful bunch of people. But it's been interesting. I talked with one woman who was here visiting as a pastor from Minnesota, from the Twin Cities, a year ago. And I said, do you go to your clergy women's gatherings in Minneapolis? And she said, no, I quit going because they're just too painful to go to. The stories are just too painful. And I don't know if that says something about what's happening for women in Minnesota as opposed to the Northwest, if it says something about where women are at there as opposed to here, but as Nancy said, I think there's a real healthy sense of, yes, there's pain to share, but there's also a sense of we're moving past the angry stories and onto some constructive strategizing, which is exactly what we meet for now at various times as specific strategy.
Carol, I just want to pick up on that because I want to share, unless you, either of you are going to share what happened.
Go ahead, you know, please share it.
I would like to share my perception of what happened. On Friday night, the women of the ELCA got together with the clergy women who were having a conference simultaneously, and it was to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the ordination of women. Inserted into the worship service was 50 minutes of a theatrical presentation that was an absolute tirade and anger that came out of the theatrical production of all the Bible passages that condemn women, that say they should shut up. The women that did the presentation had interviewed maybe two dozen women, Lutheran, Jewish women going to be ordained as rabbis, Roman Catholic women who were not allowed to be ordained. They took their stories and made them a series of vignettes, but it got angrier and angrier and angrier, and instead of being celebration, people started leaving, and my guess is left before it was over. It was so heavy, and I felt kind of destructive. A couple of them would have been funny, and yes, you could relate to that, but it just went on and on. I went up to my room, and my roommate was there with two other women, and I walked in the door, and they just said, why did they vomit all over us tonight? If those women are so angry about what is happening to them, why are they in the parish ministry? And I tried to defend the presentation, saying things like, well, if even one or two of our sisters are hurt and angry, we need to listen to them. But these women were very, very upset by the presentation, much more so than I felt. Anyway, next morning I talked to two or three women pastors from the Minnesota area that I knew, and they said they had been up till 3 a.m. crying and trying to figure out how to mend this rift that they perceived between the women of the Lutheran Church and the women clergy. And that they just felt like this had put a big wedge in, and that yes, some women were still hurting and angry, but they wanted to get past that anger, which, as I talked to a woman last week from Canada who was ordained, she said, our women don't seem to get past that anger. We have a 3-day conference, and it just stays on the anger, and it never moves out to the celebration or to the ministry. And I just wanted to say that first of all, the president of the women of the church gave a disclaimer for what happened the night before. She apologized, and many of the women clergy were over there to hear that apology. But I was so worried that the women in the church were going to feel almost alienated from the women clergy, just feeling like, what have we done to make these women so upset, and forgetting that, well, first of all, that it was a theatrical presentation, and also that, yeah, some women still are hurting and angry, but it seemed to me that it was great that they, most women clergy there seem to want to move on beyond that.
Well, we were also extremely upset by that. I mean, it was just massive, just being very upset afterwards. And there were many of us that stayed up quite late working on the statement that Sandy, whatever her name was, read on our behalf that next morning. I think that I happened to know the details of how that happened, and it was a snafu of major proportions. Mainly that the script that the theatrical group sent to the Commission for Women was not what they presented. So it was very unfortunate. There was some very good healing, I think, that came out of it on both sides. And I know one commitment that all the women in Anaheim made, which we did, was to check in with our women from our synods who were there and make sure that that was okay. But I think one of the most poignant statements for me that came out of that was when I left at the end of the vignettes and started, we were talking about what we were going to do about this and stuff like that, but then two of my colleagues, one from my synod and one from Southwest Synod here in Washington, were out, and they were speaking with about three or four women from who had walked out. And this one woman, I have no idea where these women were from or anything, but this one woman just said, "We came here tonight really wanting to celebrate the beautiful and graceful ministry of our women pastor, and we are just crushed that we couldn't do that." I thought that was a very poignant statement.
Can I say, I think, I mean, I wasn't there. I didn't hear it. It does sound like it was really overdone. I'll just say, though, having experienced a lot of resistance, it is, and Nancy did too. I mean, you were interim pastor for many years in Seattle before you finally got a call. It's hard to know what to do with that sort of bitterness and anger about that. And it doesn't happen too often anymore, but I remember one time I was at Bible camp with a bunch of pastors, and we were out in the water, this, you know, and sort of horse around back and forth, and suddenly this guy says to me, "You know, I don't really see how you can justify being a pastor and taking a call away from a man who needs it to feed his family." And so you never know when that's going to happen, and then it's really hard to get over it. I mean, I hope this wasn't my motivation for going to grad school, but I know I'm still terrified of the prospect of having to interview and get turned down. And because I don't know that I could get a call, even though, you know, I suppose I met, well, I guess I met 10,000 people, no, 15,000 people at Holy. If we say that 5,000 people go through here every summer, I don't know. No, some of them come back. Okay. You know, some of them were on call committees, or they should, you know me by now. But I don't know that I could get a call. I mean, it's sort of that same feeling of just that combination of terror and anger over experiencing discrimination that I don't think men experience in the same way. Although I agree with Nancy. I mean, it's hard for men to get calls now too in many places in the country, not everywhere, but it's not a real secure path for anyone. But it is hard to know what to do about the memories of having experienced that. I would say still, I mean, it is really exciting to see the number of women and the acceptance. Still, I think the income disparity is probably really significant between the average woman and average man of equal number of years out of seminary. I mean, I would say that typically men follow a sort of path of advancement or whatever you want to call it that is often blocked to women. And, you know, you hate to think that money matters, and I certainly say it doesn't. But then, you know, I mean, it's just sort of, you know, some of those measures at points at which women are still not following the same path that seems to be open to men. Still in the Lutheran Church, we don't have any women bishops. I mean, there's still very few women on seminary faculties. I mean, I don't think it's, well, it's mixed, and so then it's hard to know. But it does sound like that scenario at Anaheim was kind of a disaster.
I have a question. Do any of you wear collars? And if not, how do you identify yourselves as pastors?
I wear my collar every 4th of July parade at Holden Village.
I wear mine for all hospital visits, all worship experiences, and then it's debatable. When I wear it, if I wear it to the office or not. I just say I'm a pastor. If I tell people I'm a pastor, and they usually believe me. Sometimes they say, "A what?"
I don't very often. I do sometimes for hospital visits. See, another struggle I have, I'll just say this, I mean, you can all tag me for this one, is I think, and this is part of my ambivalence about wearing a collar too, as well as being a really low church person, I'm not convinced that ordination is Jesus' will for anybody. I'll say that. I think for him, his baptism was his ordination, and that was enough. And I'm not really sure that we should have ordination at all as we have it now. And that was a real struggle for me in deciding to be ordained. I knew I wanted to be in ministry, but I didn't know whether it was even right to participate in a rite that I have real questions about. So I think putting on a collar has a lot of mixed feelings for me.
I wear a collar with my vestments at all times. Whenever I lead worship in any setting, I don't always have my vestments, a funeral in another place or a wedding in another place. In Seattle, which is what I fondly call the most pagan city in the U.S., it is the most secular city, which is true, by the way. very often, it's a detriment to show up in your collar, because nobody knows what it is. And early on in my ministry, I learned early on that I was told by a couple doctor friends of mine that they felt that wearing a collar to make a hospital call was actually more detrimental to other patients' health than, you know, when there weren't very many of us, you know. I can get into that practice.
I want to add two things to that besides my smart remark at the beginning. I remember the time I happened to be home in Chicago and I went to Bishop Chilstrom's installation as bishop of the ELCA. And I remember saying to some friends there, why are all these pastors wearing their collars? Yeah, you know, they're not here as pastors. And I felt real angry that, you know, they're kind of sporting this, like they had to stick out from the crowd. But then someone else said to me, but isn't it nice to see these women with their collars, that you have some ability then to identify how many women pastors are here? But for me, I think I can only tolerate it in a functional situation. You know, when people go wearing their collar, you know, as they're driving around town for no reason or something,
get good parking space.
Well, yeah. Or my uncle and
free food at McDonald's.
When he was a pastor in Brooklyn, his wife always told him to wear his collar because then when he got a speeding ticket, the police would say, "I'm sorry, Father," and not, you know, give. But it also came up for me just the other day in talking with the senior pastor at the church where I'm interviewing, and I don't remember how it came up, but he said that the prior associate, who was a woman, wore her collar all the time, and I said, "Uh-oh," and I said, "You know, for me, really, a collar is still a male symbol. It does not feel authentically female. I just have not seen that many women with it on." And he said, "Well, that'll be interesting." He explained why she chose to wear that and how there's just a few different groups in downtown Seattle, and you're either a visitor or a business person. He found it gave him a way for identifying himself in that milieu of folks there, as well as some of the other practical reasons for it. But so it's a, I appreciate your question because it's a struggle that's ahead for me yet. It's, you know, kind of a moot point at Holden. But I don't know what I will do with that.
I've been really struck this year by the juxtaposition of the 20th anniversary of the celebration of the ordination of women, some women in the Lutheran Church, with the rejection of the ordination of Ruth and Phyllis in San Francisco, making a very clear statement that lesbian women are not having their ministries recognized through ordination process. And I'm wondering if that was present at all in Anaheim and what kind of discussion there was among either heterosexual or closeted lesbian women who are ordained versus openly lesbian women who are rejected.
Ruth and Phyllis were both there. And one afternoon they did some conversation time with everyone who's interested in doing that. I understand it was well attended. I was not there. Were you there?
They
for that?
Did something one night after everything was over, and it was in a room, in a hotel room. It was just utterly packed.
Yeah.
I mean, people couldn't
get in. You couldn't get in. And I think for the most part, I know at the very last day, there was a time when people could get up and say what they were taking home with them from the event. And Ruth stood up and she said, "I'm going to take home this terrific sense of solidarity with women who are ordained." And she also thanked her lesbian sisters who are both silent and open, but in full-time ordained ministry in the church, for their support, and wished for a day when everybody's support and solidarity could be equally celebrated. And I would say the standing ovation was about 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I think it was very, very powerful moment.
That was at the...
Our last session together of the women clergy.
The women clergy, yes. Not the...
No, it wasn't the women of the LCA.
Was that issue raised at the women of the LCA?
No.
I attended that event also, and I was struck by, there were like 135 different workshops that you could choose from to attend at 5 different times. And there were like 2 on AIDS and 1 on gays and lesbians, how can we support them in the church? And with Phyllis and Ruth there, I was really struck by that. And Paul, at the same time, the whole thing with the ordination of the gays and lesbians, mm-hmm. there was not, I never heard a thing said. And I guess I was really perking my ears up to that just because we've discussed it so much here at Holden.
And Dan, I would add to that, not only having them, Ruth and Phyllis, there was powerful, but also I had the experience of reunioning with a college friend who I hadn't seen for quite a while, who shared with me that she's lesbian. She's still a pastor, and how she's trying to work that and to continue to be in the clergy restroom. It's just really sad.
I've been trying to think of something I could say that was helpful. Up until January, I spent 2.5 years at a Lutheran seminary, and there's a whole different feeling, it seems, among the women there about some of the issues. The feeling is that there's a backlash in the church, and there a lot of women are really scared, and going out into the interview process, like you'd said, a lot of them realized they weren't really prepared for what was going to be presented to them. And there was really still a lot of encountering of what had been considered obsolete sexism. And this backs up even into our junior year when, in the endorsement process, the interviews that we all had to go to, thinking of Dan's question, we were all asked what our sexual preference was. And there was a lot of questions about, I'm single, and why I'm single. I mean, there's a lot of oppression, and it's tough. And I didn't want to share anything, because I think, you know, I don't want what I'm saying to be interpreted that, you know, open up new wounds, but I think it's a mistake to ignore wounds that are there. And there can't be any healing unless people are open about this backlash. I really agree that there is a backlash, that not only women aren't getting the full pastorates, they're not even getting to some of the associates. But this was at Warburg Seminary.
Yeah, I can say it at Harvard Divinity School, now being back there, that I don't know what I would do now. Seminarians all over the country, to get endorsement by their synodical committees, are having to sign their name to saying that they are in compliance with the statement that the church has drafted that is really restrictive. I mean, it's you sign on to single people pledge to live a life of chaste celibacy. It used to just be celibacy, now they added chaste celibacy. And I mean, it's all about,
right.
Well, I don't
That's
know.
Right.
I guess what's very, very distressing to me is it's nothing about the other 9 commandments. It's nothing about, you know, just economic justice, mm-hmm. or issues of race or violence, nonviolence kinds of things. It's not a vision of the gospel except for a very, very specific and restrictive commitment as far as sexuality. And I'll just say to all of you who are going to be parishioners or whatever, if we go along with this as a church, we're going to miss the gifts of some of the best pastors who are already out there. Thank goodness they've already made it through. And some of the finest seminarians. I feel like I should write something. Somebody needs to write something for the magazine just saying that. And I'm scared to, because of the repercussions as far as stuff like that. I agree with you. I think it's a terrible situation.
What's the difference between celibacy and chastity?
Yeah, I know.
Celibacy, you're not married.
You're single.
Yeah, and chastity constantly used it wrong. Yeah.
Chastity is sexual activity. In other words, isn't that right?
Yeah, I know. And they even spell it out in that document. They tell you what that is. They say no genital sexual activity. I mean, you That's just right. wonder, is this what the gospel, is this, did Jesus die for this statement? I mean, is this yeah, our, yeah. don't, can't we, you know, at least have, say, the creed or, you know, but no, it spells it out. In case you don't know what chaste celibacy is, they even tell you what that is. And then you have to sign it and send it in to your office.
I'm a single person, and with the minute this came up, one thing I just keep asking my bishop, and I say, you go ask the other bishops about this, and I say, when are you going to come to some of us that are already out there and ask us about our sex life? I just say, Lord, where are you going to ask me? You know? And the thing
doesn't
is,
doesn't want to know.
No, I mean, of course, I don't want to know any of it either way, and the whole thing is just, and I think we always need to be concerned when we're so concerned about the moral behavior. Of our
it's not
clergy.
Just moral, don't even narrow down to that.
No.
Sexual
moral behavior, whatever. It's such a limited thing. And why in the world, in a church that trains pastors probably better than any other church and has this wonderful vision of the office and wonderful theology around that and everything, and why are they worrying about that when maybe we should be worrying about, you know, I think a more appropriate question is, do you read the texts for the day before you preach on them? I think that's an important question. What are the three creeds? You know, I mean, I think that stuff is key. And, you know, unless they're, you know, engaged in some flagrant, awful activity, be it social, economic, sexual, or whatever, my word, let the people live their lives and be pastors.
I think it's a question of abuse that we need to get at, too, you know, in all of those issues, areas.
And married heterosexuals commit abuse, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the, you know, it's not just sexual abuse, it's abuse of a congregation. It's abuse, you know, of children. All of those questions, I mean, in terms of our lifestyle and behavior that don't get the same level of, you know, that sometimes I think are, that destroy relationship.
What do you think is the stimulus for that?
Oh, it's the whole gay lesbian.
It's the gay lesbian thing. Sure. And somebody said, well, if you're going to ask that question right. of people who are gay and lesbian, then you need to ask that question of those who are heterosexual.
It
just
have
to be
logical, right? Yeah. So therefore, it's gotten spread in that.
That's right. So now it's all people who are single. Therefore, you know, the assumption is that gay and lesbian people are all single. Right, they're not. Yes. You know, the church does not recognize marriage, though, for persons who are gay and lesbian. Therefore, you know, that's kind of how it's.
But I think the church, you know, and that's all of us, of course, needs to really struggle with the issue of. I mean, I think we know. I know. You know, most people would, if they had their first choice of a pastor, would rather. First choice would be a straight white man between the ages of 30 and 45 who's married and has 2.3 children.
And is clean shaven.
Yeah, and is clean shaven, no beard. but then there's the question of what do you do if you can't get that? Or, I mean, how can we broaden our vision of what ministry is all about? And I think it's to each one of us to challenge that and to say that a gay person might be the most effective pastor of my congregation in terms of the criteria of the gospel, or a single person. I mean, we've got that would be another whole issue, a really interesting one. I mean, we not only have no women bishops, we have no single bishops either. We have one person of color who's a bishop in the Lutheran Church, but everybody pretty much fits that mold of what is everybody's
gray
favorite.
Hair.
They're all 55.
This is not a, you know, I shouldn't have even said that, because then that sounds like you shouldn't have gray hair, but I mean, they're sort of, they all look alike. I'm sorry, Scott. I was looking at Jody, and I was like, whoops. But they all look alike. so many of them look alike that just stand them up and they kind of, oh, they're a bishop.
Good question.
I have a question. This is not a trick question. I'm just curious. How far do you think LCMS is from? How far do you think LCMS is from ordaining women?
Not my lifetime.
Nor mine.
I think we shouldn't or discount the way the LCMS has had deaconesses, has effectively had ordained women in a lot of roles, parochial school teachers that have been really, really important. But I think that with the preponderance now of taking an orders of creation understanding of what the call to ministry is, and that so both the orders of creation theology and recent statements on theological grounds that women are not in the image of Christ, who was male, that it's a ways away for word and sacrament ministry. But that doesn't mean that the deaconesses and school teachers aren't ordained. I mean, I think that's a kind of ordination too.
Can I tell a story here about that? And that is that I think that always the Holy Spirit's at work opening hearts around that. And certainly we know, all of us, lots of LCMS people who are in great pain around the situation in their church and around some of the many restrictions that are on all their people, also on the other side of it. When I was pastor here at Holden, one of our staff members was the daughter of a Missouri Synod district president. And all of her family came out to get her. Happened to be, it was after Easter, and like the Sunday after Easter. And there was another, an ALC pastor, a colleague of mine who was in the village, had been in the village with his family after Easter as well. And he had come up to me and said, we're leaving on Sunday and we'd like to have Eucharist before we go. And can we do that? I said, sure. But let me check. And then this other staff person came after me and said, are we going to do that? I said, yeah, we normally do that for people that are leaving on Sunday morning. And then I said, you better ask your dad, the Missouri Synod District President. I said, it's fine with me. It's more important that you have Eucharist than he get fussed, you know. So there's this other guy here who can preside just in case your dad would be uncomfortable with me doing it. So she came back and said, no, her dad said, go ahead. So we gathered here in Koinonia, just basically these two families on this Sunday morning, and we shared Holy Communion together and still the joy of Easter, of course. And this man was very quiet, and he was quiet into lunch, and we got people in the snowcats. And Karin Strum, our registrar, told me later that he was the first person to get into the snow track and got in. And as he was getting in, absolutely burst into tears and said to Karin, this is the first time in my life when I really understood what it means to be one in Christ.
To be what?
To be one in Christ. First time. And that was so powerful. We watched the man sit in the back of the snow track and just sob as he left the village. So I think there's always, you know, that gift of the power of the gospel that is much bigger than what any of us look like or do or anything. And
I want to I know we're getting close to ending here. I want to say a story, because I think that I think ordination is an incredible milestone for women, and I'm so happy to live in this age, this generation, when it can be it can be possible for us. My mother told me, and my sister, as we were in seminary, that she was going to go to Union Seminary in New York to get an MA, and then she finally decided that she wouldn't because there were no doors open in her generation. And so it's, we had no idea. I mean, it's really exciting to be living now. But I just want to say, when I went to my internship congregation in Hutchinson, you know, the young seminary, and all kind of excited about all that I had learned and stuff, and the first week I went to one of the circle meetings, the pastor said, well, you know, go visit the circle meeting. And the Bible study that week was, you know, in the Scope magazine, was on prayer. And I just sat there tongue-tied listening to these women talk about prayer with insights that, well, that really strengthened me in my own prayer and were inspiring to me. And these women were obviously in ministry and had been so for a lot longer than me, and in truly amazing ways to one another. And so I think as we talk about women in ministry, maybe the most important thing is that perhaps women's ordination has opened doors to everyone understanding their calling as ministers of the gospel. And I believe that's what it's all about.
I also just wanted to say one other thing too that I didn't say at the beginning, but I think that it's just different with women. It's not better or worse or whatever. But I think people need to recognize that when a woman is doing leading worship, liturgy, preaching, whatever, in that role, something's different, and you feel different, and we need to maybe start dealing with those, what this feels like. And the story I didn't share was the woman in the first congregation I served who really hated to see me go. She was just a real church person, and what she said to me though was, I don't feel like, you know, I'm saying goodbye to my pastor. I feel like I'm saying goodbye to my friend. And she distinguished between the two. I mean, her whole life she'd been this rigid woman, who believed that she was responsible for her children's sins until they were confirmed. I mean, that's how caught up in this whole thing she was. So for her to say that was that she recognized I was her pastor. But I was not the pastor that she was used to. And that's my, you know, kind of how I sort of try to function in this role sometimes.
As important as I think it is that women are ordained in the Lutheran Church or in any other church, I always have to do that with sort of a both and. Because for me, some of my most powerful models of ministry have been lay people.
That's right.
And my first choice for a person to preach at my ordination was a lay person. We finally decided after much conversation that we wouldn't do that. But and so in the same way that you, Barbara, had that experience at your parish, I continually struggle with the clericalism that can creep in as we celebrate our roles as ordained ministers as opposed to the other kinds of ministries that we find ourselves in. And so I want to celebrate all of those ministries.